This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with a former long-term detainee in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
We speak with both the author of Guantanamo Diary, Mohamedou Salahi, and his criminal defense lawyer, Nancy Hollander. Give a listen. The world has truly changed since 9/11.
We'll consider the issue of whether a public access TV channel run by a private nonprofit is subject to the First Amendment.
This is a threat to community video. There are six major corporations that run the major media. We're trying to change that from the ground up. Let's see what happens.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The American offshore prison camp in Guantanamo, Cuba is still operating. After the attacks on September 11, 2001, it was set up as a place where neither American nor international law would apply and where prisoners could be brought, tortured, detained forever, and never charged with a crime. 10 years ago, former President Obama promised to close the offshore prison when he ran for office. It remains up and running to this day. Mohamedou Ould Salahi spent 14 years of his life there. He was an electrical engineer from Mauritania in Africa and educated in Germany. He was 32 years old when he was apprehended in his home, taken to Jordan where he was tortured, then to Afghanistan, and then to Guantanamo. And 16 years later, at age 48, he was finally released. He walked out of Guantanamo Bay Prison in October of 2016 without ever being charged with a crime and returned to his native Mauritania. While in prison in 2005, he wrote a memoir in English, one of his four languages. His attorney, Nancy Hollander, had asked him to do it, and she finally got it declassified in 2012, but with heavy redactions. It was made into a book titled Guantanamo Diary and published in 2015 and became an international bestseller. In it, he describes how he was tortured in ways personally approved by then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Torture is a criminal act under both U.S. and international law. As many know, Rumsfeld has never been prosecuted. We're joined today by Mohamedou Salahi from his native country in Mauritania, where he is a writer, and also his attorney, Nancy Hollander. Nancy is a criminal defense attorney, a former president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and a partner in the New Mexico law firm of Friedman, Boyd, Hollander, Goldberg, Urias, and Ward. Mohamedou and Nancy, welcome to Law and Disorder. And in your case, Nancy, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on Law and Disorder again. I so appreciate it, and I appreciate your having Mohamedou Salahi on the show because I think it's crucial that people hear from him especially and know that he's not forgotten and that we not forget about Guantanamo and the people who are still there.
Mohamedou, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Mohamedou, tell us, how did you fit the profile of a terrorist?
I couldn't put it better than FBI agent Robert Seidler from San Diego. He looked at me one day, and he told me, if it looks like a dog, walks like a dog, and barks like a dog, then it's a dog. And then that was like so chilling for me, because that was the first time I heard this expression. And then my English was very basic, and I was not prepared for to answer this question, what he put to me, because he told me that I was young, I was Arab, I was educated in the West, I studied technical discipline, and I have quote-unquote terrorist friends. And speaking of that, what really attracts the attention of the American law enforcement was a phone call that I received from my cousin Abu Hafs, who was affiliated with the late UPL. And he was asked me to help his father, who was then sick, sending him some money or helping his son sending him some money. That phone call was intercepted and passed on to the German authorities, who did their own investigation and came back to the United States and told them, as I understand, we cannot hold him, we cannot even question him, because he didn't break any law. And yes, that was the trigger. And there was no saving me. The only way to save myself was to be in a country that respects the law. And the United States patiently waited on to get me where there is no law, i.e. in Africa, where I was kidnapped and taken to different places.
When you were kidnapped, do you mind telling us a few of the details of how that transpired and what you were feeling?
So the first thing that happened, the United States and the government of Canada, unfortunately, in my government, conspired to lure me away from Canada. And they decided that Mauritania would be a good place to do whatever they want with me. So my government talked to my family. They said that they have to call me back home for my own sake to protect me, because otherwise very bad thing could happen to me. My family called me and they said that my mother was sick. And I decided to travel. On my way, my plane made a landing in Senegal, in Dakar, Senegal. And I was arrested. And after 5 days of interrogation, Senegalese decided they couldn't hold me anymore. And it was up to the United States to take me to the United States if they thought I broke some law. The United States said no. And then they said, Senegalese said, we have them to let go of him. They said, the Americans said, no, you have to arrange for him to force him back to Mauritania. And then the United States chartered a plane, a French plane, that took me and delivered me to Mauritania. And the rest was a story. So I was held. That was January of 2000. And my passport was taken away. And I was, I started to look for a job. And this is, I tried to make the best out of my life. So, and after the 9/11, everything changed. Now, there was no limit to how much law they could break. I was taken, I was called, and I was arrested and sent to Jordan. I plead with them to send me to the United States. Because if I did anything, it should have been against the United States. And I want to try my chance with American court. And but they said, no, the United States want you in Jordan. And I was completely shocked because I've never been to Jordan. I never applied to visit Jordan. I don't have family in Jordan. Nothing. Zilch. And I know from reading news and so that Jordan has a very bad reputation of being a country that was doing the dirty bidding of the United States of America, i.e. torturing people, disappearing them, and hold them outside the rule of law. And it's needless to say that I was terrified. I cannot describe to you how terrified I was. I was like a child. Every move around me in that plane, I interpreted as being something that was going to hurt me. And, yes.
Mahamadou, what crimes were you charged with?
Whatsoever. I was never charged with any crime.
And can you tell us, what was it like when you first met Nancy in 2005 in Guantanamo?
Yeah, I... it's funny because your program is Law and Disorder. So in Germany, the only thing I know about the United States are movies and shows, TV shows. So I watch like Law and Order, Columbus, and stuff like that, and Mad with Children. So, and when they told me Nancy is going to see me, I was so elated. I was so you out ASAP. And I was really happy. So he came to me. He didn't know that I was that I spoke somewhat English. She had a translator. Her colleague spoke some French. Then, but I told them I was cool, and then I was so happy. You know, I made some note trying to explain to her what happened to me. You know, I didn't know it would take many, many more years than I thought it would take to get me out of prison.
Nancy, talk about your first meeting with Mahamudu.
Well, my first meeting, I didn't know anything about Mahamudu at all. And so I went with another lawyer who spoke French because we didn't even know if he spoke English. We went there, walked into the hut where we were meeting with him, and he stood up and he held his arms out to, and we didn't know what was going on. And then we realized that he was shackled to the floor with a bolt around his ankle, and he couldn't move. So Sylvia and I walked into his arms, and he held us. And I believe his words were my lawyer's. And it was an incredible moment.
And then you asked Mahamudu to write down what had happened to him. Talk about your legal battle to get this diary published.
I asked him, and Mahamudu will laugh at this because he was kind of angry at me. I asked him to write down everything his interrogators had asked him during the last year or so when he'd been interrogated and tortured. And he said, that's like asking Charlie Sheen how many girlfriends he's had. And he was kind of upset with me, but he started doing it. And he wrote these letters to me over the course of the year, which ultimately became this book. Then we had a big, long legal battle, and it finally got out 7 years later with redactions.
How many redactions?
2,500 words were redacted.
Mahamudu, Donald Rumsfeld, who was George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense at the time, had a special plan for your interrogation. Can you tell us what that consisted of and what they did to you?
It's needless to say that I did not get that memo, unfortunately. But what I did get is the result of that memo. So, FBI agent Rod and Chris came to me around mid-2003. And they told me, they gave me a list of 15 people. They told me, those people are the worst of the worst in this camp. And I was like smiling. Said so. He said, you are number one in this list. And I said, okay, are you suggesting, so those people you captured on the battlefield with a gun pointed at you? He said, yes. Said, you captured me. I was home, working, feeding my family, thousands of miles away from any battlefield. He said, yes. But you are number one. And then all of them are not even in this list, only very few. So I took this as a joke. But in the end, the joke was on me, because those FBI agents were right, and I was wrong in my assessment of their of what they told me. So, and then they came back to me, they said, we're sorry, we have to leave you, we have to leave you to a special team. And that special team started with me, put me on this diet. I call it the diet. So the first 70 days, sleepless, interrogation 24. They used technique including what I described in the book, sexual assault, physical abuse. And in the boat ride when they forced me to drink water and they beat me almost to death, I passed out many times. Deprived me of everything in myself. They prevented me from taking taking my medication that I badly needed. Even one Navy officer, and this is on record, he told them, this is very dangerous, you do. And when I saw that he was on my side because he was talking to the guard, I told him, I need you to help me. And then he said, I'm sorry, but it's not my call. I can only write the people, but it's not my call what happens to. And yeah, it was really bad, you know, to say the least. And to be honest, I ended up throwing the towel after about 80 days, I think, because I lost conscience for many days. I couldn't count anymore. And after about 80 days, I told them, I'm ready to write, to sign any confession you suggest. And they told me exactly what they wanted me to confess to, and I forcibly confessed to everything. And that was a big relief for me, to be honest with you.
If you don't mind sharing some of what happened to you, and I know it must be difficult, but what others at black sites around the world have been described by Mark Danner in the New York Times as, quote, a globalized version of the Salem witch trials, with zealous inquisitors, untroubled by doubt, applying a relentless violence to conjure a fantasy world born of collective terrors of their own imagination. And as you've just said, they forced you to admit to things that were untrue, and they also forced you to falsely implicate other people. When Trump ran for president, he said that torture works. Can you talk about that a bit?
Thank you first for reminding me. One of the things that really hurt me so bad is not what I confessed about myself falsely, but what I said about other people whom I know to be innocent. But at some point, whenever they say a name, do you know this guy? This is my cue to say, yes, he's a bad guy. I know him. A bad guy meaning he goes to the mosque. He has friends. He went to Bosnia or Afghanistan or wherever. I told my lawyer, Nancy, I did say this and that about X, Y, and Z. And I wanted to tell their lawyers that this is false. And I can say this, you know, because he cannot tell you this. And then she said to me back then, when I remember that, she cannot tell them everything that I say, but she will let them know that I was subject to torture. And that would help them defend their clients better. And so far, thank God, you know, I was never forced to testify before a trial against anyone. And I'm very happy for that. So the other thing, you know, we have to admit, I'm going to admit that terrorism is a big challenge. But the way United States dealt with terrorism is shameful. You know, in this country today, in my country, people could be sent to jail without due process. And when human rights people and lawyers cry, you know, foul, my government has a very ready and good response. They said, the United States is the first democracy in the world, and they do it. Why don't we do it? It does not say we are not democratic, but if security of the state is threatened, we can act outside the rule of law. And that is established because the United States has a precedent doing so. I know this is not an excuse for an authoritarian regime, but it's a very hard argument to defeat in this country, in this part of the world. And you're right. I was in the first, like, torture session I had, of course, in Jordan. You know, and the worst thing, you know, I remember is when they put me beside someone who's been tortured with my blindfolded, you know. It's like the beating, and so I was beaten once. The beating was not as hard as when they put me and then listening for so long, you know, for someone who is suffering. I wish the suffering was on me. You know, I cannot describe it. No, I cannot describe this to anyone who hasn't been through it. And in Bagram, the same thing.
When George Bush's vice president, Dick Cheney, was asked about an innocent man like Mohamedou, he was asked about an innocent man who had been tortured to death at an American black site in Afghanistan, he did not hesitate to reply, quote, "I am more concerned with bad guys who get out and released than I am with a few that, in fact, were innocent." What's wrong with that?
Well, everything is wrong with that, because it's the innocent people that we have to worry about first, and it's the history of the U.S. justice system that we protect the innocent and we make sure that no innocent people are ever found guilty, even if some guilty people must go free. So he's turned the whole justice system on its head.
Mohamedou, when you were arrested in 2000, they thought you were in Al-Qaeda, and you were not, but you were never charged with any crime. And in 2010, you won your habeas hearing. Former head prosecutor at Guantanamo, Morris Davis, said, "We have nothing against him." But you didn't get out of Guantanamo until 2016. I want to ask both you and your attorney, Nancy Hollander, why was that?
It's really very simple. The Obama administration, while on the one hand it said it wanted to close Guantanamo, on the other hand, the Justice Department, the Obama Justice Department, appealed every single habeas case that was won in district court, except maybe one. They appealed them all instead of just letting them stand. If they had let it stand, Mohamedou would have gotten out, as the judge ordered, Judge Robertson ordered in 2010. Instead, it was appealed. It's a complicated legal issues that happened in the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, but the case was remanded. It went back to the district court. The district court sat on it, I think not wanting it to go back again and lose again, and so he didn't get out until another procedure called the Periodic Review Board released him.
Double down on what Nancy said. I know Nancy understands all these ins and outs, but for me as a detainee, I was told Obama wants to send you home. And okay, I said, okay, send me home. They said, no. And then I said, okay, I'm going to court. And then my interrogators came to me and said, don't go to court. If you go to court, it's going to be harder for you to go home. I said, you are not sending me home. They said, okay, I'm just telling you. And then I went to court and I won my habeas. And what the government did, they look at people, and the people who did not win, who went to the same class, didn't win, they were sent home. And I was punished not to be sent home, and that was really very odd to me, to say the least.
Are there still detainees there? If so, why haven't they been released or tried?
There are 40 people still in Guantanamo. Five of them are the 9/11 defendants, whose case may get tried someday, although who knows when. One of them is my other client, Abrahim El-Nasri, who's there allegedly for the USS Cole bombing. That case is at the moment stopped, and who knows when it will be tried. There's another case pending trial, and the rest of them are what are called forever prisoners, meaning the U.S. has no intention of ever releasing them, even though they've never been charged with any crime, just like Mohamedou's situation.
So why and what will it take to close Guantanamo?
Well, what it would take to close Guantanamo would be to, first of all, release all the people who haven't been charged with crimes. That's what we do in American justice. We either charge people or release them. And the others could be tried in federal court, if they can be tried, and proceed with the normal American justice system. Otherwise, it's never going to close. And I don't think there is any intention of ever closing it.
Mohamedou, can you tell us what you're doing now and describe what your life is like?
What I'm doing now is I'm writing for the most part. And I have some books in the pipeline, and I hope soon to my next book is about the tale of a Bedouin and who lost his she camel, and he went on a perilous journey to bring it back home. And it speaks about a lifestyle that is far away and hidden from the Western eye. And I just bring it to that audience and to my own audience. And so I also trying to fix my health, because I have had an operation in Guantanamo Bay and to remove my gallbladder. And I've had so much post-operative pain still to these days. And my doctor wants me to go abroad to seek a medical treatment. And because I don't have any passport, I'm prevented from seeking that crucial and necessary medical treatment. Of course, I also want to do the advertisement for the next movie directed by Kevin MacDonald. They turned my Guantanamo diary into a screenplay, and it's going to be amazing, and I hope that people react to it and watch it. I just want to say, just to second Nancy on what she said, and I just want to ask a question: where are you guys to draw the line? As someone who loves democracy, who loves the rule of law, I don't understand why the United States think it's not important to respect the law. Because disrespecting the law of one person means disrespecting the rule of law in general. Because in dictatorships, they don't take 20 million people and put them in prison. They take very few people and torture them. And they say the other people are good people. We don't put them in prison. So where is the line going to be drawn? I just wonder.
Mahamadou, if you don't mind our asking, do you have nightmares about your years at Guantanamo?
Absolutely. You know, some nights when I like watch the news and then remember Guantanamo Bay, I wake like sweating, and you know, I think I'm back to Guantanamo Bay. And then people who sleep beside me said that it's very hard to sleep beside me because I talk so much in my sleep, and sometimes cry in my sleep.
Nancy, your final thoughts.
Look, Guantanamo Bay started as an experiment where the government of the United States under President Bush thought there would never be any lawyers, never any accountability. They could put people there. They could put people in the black sites. No one would ever care. No one would know. No one could do anything about it. They were wrong. And we fought very hard to get people out, to keep this alive, and we continue to fight this battle. But what starts in Guantanamo will become part of the American justice system as it has, and we will see the eroding of the U.S. justice system to match Guantanamo, and that is a big fear of the direction that we're going.
How can people keep up with your work, Nancy?
Well, people can read Guantanamo Diary. It's available in 27 languages. You can read it in whatever language you want. I'm on Twitter. Mahamadou's on Twitter. You can follow us there. But I suggest you start by reading the book. This book is the best way to learn about Guantanamo.
And you have a website?
I have a website for my law firm, fbdlaw.com.
Mahamadou, do you have any parting thoughts?
I just want to thank you very much for having me. And I really want American people to stand for what it's right and close Guantanamo Bay. Close that dark, black speck on beautiful American people. Beautiful American people don't deserve Guantanamo Bay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mahamadou. We so appreciate your joining us.
Mahamadou, you have our respect and our solidarity. Nancy Hollander, thank you so much for your good work over the years, and especially with Mahamadou. And we appreciate both of you being on Law and Disorder.
Bye-bye. Salaam alaikum.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. As a public access TV channel run by a private nonprofit corporation subject to the First Amendment? The Supreme Court will consider that question in a case involving the Manhattan Neighborhood Network, or MNN. In 1991, MNN was designated to operate a public access channel in New York City. The Manhattan Borough President has no control over MNN, but does pick two of its 13 board members. In 2012, Jesus Papaleto Melendez, an occasional contributor to MNN, was suspended for trying to attend a board meeting. His associate Dee Halleck then recorded him outside talking about his situation. MNN banned the video from airing, and Melendez and Dee brought a First Amendment claim against MNN, asking if the network is a state actor for purposes of their First Amendment rights. The district court said no, noting that while it was a close call, other circuit courts had concluded that privately run public access networks were not state actors. Joining us today is Dee Halleck, one of the plaintiffs in the case and a former guest of Law and Disorder. We're also joined by attorney Paul W. Hughes, a partner in the New York law firm Mayor Brown's appellate and Supreme Court practice. Paul has handled more than 200 appellate matters, more than 125 of which were in the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2017, the American lawyer named Hughes Litigator of the Week in connection with his immigration work. Paul and Dee Dee, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, it's nice to be back.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dee Dee, let's start by talking about your early involvement with Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
Well, actually, before Manhattan had a real center for public access, a group of us lobbied to get some of that there. And so we had an organization called the New York Citizens Committee for Responsible Media. And it included people from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and also the United Church of Christ Communications Office and many different organizations. And we met actually in the Paper Tiger office.
What are public access channels and why were they formed?
Public access channels are the rent that is paid for the use of the public rights of way when Verizon or any of the big companies come to dig up your streets and your sidewalks. They are using what was really a public right of way. So the public access channels and also the funds, a portion of the profits either go to the city or to creating centers where people can make their own channels. It's sort of because when a cable company comes in, they're really getting a kind of monopoly of information, and so it's seen as a way of combating that. And it took, this was in the 80s, 70s and 80s, there was a lot of mobilization of people to try to ensure that the public would get some of the quite large profits that were being made by cabling up cities.
So, Dee Dee, do you consider the Manhattan Neighborhood Network as a community resource?
For sure. It's a public soapbox. The city makes an agreement with a nonprofit. And now there, in our case, there people have said, well, the state doesn't have anything to do with it, or the city in this case. But actually, at any time, the city can revoke the license. And in fact, they in 2013, there was a renewal of the agreement between the city and the nonprofit, which is the Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
So what is MNN's link to the government?
Well, there are two members of the board who are appointed by the borough president. But the main thing is that it is a payment that the cable company gives in exchange for the public rights of way to keep the government out of manipulating the content. However, they give it to a nonprofit, but they choose the nonprofit. There are several cities where they've actually changed the nonprofits. Albuquerque is one. Albuquerque had a channel that was organized by a group called Quote Unquote, which was very wonderful. They had a lot of native programs. They had Democracy Now! And a conservative city government came in and actually took the agreement away and canceled their contract. And so a very conservative group came in and took over the public access, and they stopped running Democracy Now!
That's a useful background. Let's get to the issue at hand. Didi, how did this particular dispute arise? I understand you were banned from attending a meeting, a board meeting of MNN.
When we first started with the NCRM, the New York Citizens Committee for Responsible Media, one of the things we were concerned with is that there was, at that point, there was only one center, and we suggested, and Ruth Messenger was the borough president at the time, and she totally agreed and thought it was a wonderful idea that there should be these community media grants that would go to different organizations throughout the city that would train people and give them equipment and enable the media production to be made in other places besides 59th Street. So those grants went on for 19 years, and there were all kinds of wonderful groups like the Lower East Side Girls Club and the ACT UP got one, Esperanza, the Dominican Women's Association, really a lot of very interesting groups were able to make programming based on those grants. And one of the things that really upset a number of us was that they were taken away in the mid-2000s. And we really wanted to go to the board meeting to ask that they be reinstated. We were told that the board meetings were closed, and Popoletto, who came to the meeting, because he had been a recipient of the grants, he was doing video with an ESL class. He was told that he, because he had gone to the board meeting, he was a traitor. We were very upset, and so he talked about this, his banning from this a leadership training class. I videotaped him in front of the building, and I put that video on, and all of a sudden I was banned. So I was banned for a year, and Popoletto was banned for life. And so we felt this public access is supposed to be even in MNN's handbook, they say that public access is to enable people to exercise their First Amendment. And that's what we were doing.
Well, let's bring your attorney, Paul Hughes, into the picture here, Didi. Paul, why and how did you get involved in this litigation?
Well, it's a good question. I've been involved in several cases involving fundamental First Amendment rights issues in a variety of causes touching on civil rights and civil liberties. Didi has been represented by several years by Robert Perry, a lawyer in New York who knows perhaps more about public access television than anyone out there. And Robert had represented Didi in the district court as well as up before the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit. after the MNN decided to petition to the Supreme Court, Robert reached out to me, as my practice focuses on Supreme Court litigation, particularly civil rights litigation at the U.S. Supreme Court, to see if we could collaborate in this case in order to try to urge the best possible result at the Supreme Court in the matter. That's when I first met with Didi and became aware of the case and the enormous implications that this has for public access television.
Well, Paul, we want to talk about those bigger picture implications, but first, can you lay out simply for our audience the two issues that the Supreme Court is considering in this?
So the issues in this case is whether or not MNN qualifies as a state actor, and if it does, then the First Amendment applies to it and restricts its action. If the First Amendment does apply, we think this is a very clear-cut case of a First Amendment violation, that MNN was discriminating against Didi and Papaletto based on the viewpoint and the content of the video that they presented and put onto the airwaves, onto the public forum. The question of whether or not this MNN is a state actor, in our view, turns largely on the question of whether or not the public access channel is a public forum. Now, the public forum doctrine has long existed in American law. There are traditional public forums like the public sidewalk or the public city park, and it's long been the case that those are forums that the government cannot completely close to individuals, and they certainly can't impose viewpoint-based restrictions on individuals who are speaking or exercising their First Amendment rights in those places. Now, if there is a public forum, a city or a state cannot turn that public forum over to a nonprofit entity or a for-profit corporation and then suggest the First Amendment doesn't apply. So an example would be, it's clear the First Amendment applies to our rights to protest in a city park. If a municipality were to say that they are going to turn that park over to the trust or the administration of a nonprofit entity, the First Amendment would still apply even if a nonprofit entity were imposed. We think that's exactly what's happening in this circumstance, that because of New York City and state law, the public access channels are public forums where individuals have the freedom to speak their First Amendment messages and to exercise their First Amendment rights. And the fact that a nominally nonprofit organization is managing that public forum does nothing to change the fact that it's engaging in state activity when it administers that public forum.
What is the status of the law right now in terms of determining state action? Is there a split in the circuits?
There is not, we don't think, a meaningful split in the circuits. We think that it's very well established that if a particular forum qualifies as a public forum, then whoever operates or administers that public forum, whoever performs the gatekeeping function to it, is acting as a state actor, and therefore the First Amendment applies. We think that's very well-established law, and we are confident the Supreme Court will agree with us. The second question is whether or not MNN qualifies as a public forum, and there again, we believe we have exceedingly strong arguments based on New York state law and the structures of MNN itself. And as Didi said a few moments ago, this is something that MNN has in fact long recognized in its own mission statement. Its mission statement says that it exists, quote, to ensure the ability of Manhattan residents to exercise their First Amendment rights on an open and equitable basis. So for decades, MNN itself has realized that it is the kind of essential public forum that is critical to vibrant First Amendment rights in New York City.
Paul Hughes, what's at stake here? What happens if we lose?
Well, I think if we were to lose, that would be a sign that public forums are being closed and that states and municipalities lack the authority to designate non-traditional forums as being open for First Amendment exercise of rights. That would be a very damaging signal to the ability of states and municipalities to provide critical spaces for individuals to speak their message of all sorts. Yeah, I think the First Amendment has never been more important than it is today to have citizens be able to speak their message on an open and equitable basis and not be subject to viewpoint or content-based restrictions. If the Supreme Court were to reverse, you could easily see municipalities and states using the shell of a nonprofit in order to obviate the essential protections of the First Amendment in a way that we think would be quite dangerous.
Paul, can you talk for a minute about the composition of MNN's board of directors? We understand that two of the directors are pretty much appointed by the Manhattan Borough president, although that office doesn't control anything that MNN does. Does that factor into the test?
Well, we think what's most telling about this is the fact that MNN is operating a public forum, and because it's operating a public forum, it's performing a public function. So even if none of the directors of MNN's board were appointed by the Manhattan Bureau president, we think the same result would still accord. Now, the fact that two members are appointed by the Manhattan Bureau president, and as well as the president sitting ex officio on that board, is all the more reason to conclude that it is absolutely a state actor for purposes of the First Amendment. So I think it is confirmatory evidence that this is unquestionably a situation in which the First Amendment applies. That said, we don't think it's necessary to our argument.
Paul, do you have any allies that have filed amicus briefs? And are there other antagonists that have filed amicus briefs? Who's on our side and who's against us?
Sure. So our amicus briefs are going to be filed on January 18th, and we're working on a coalition of robust organizations. We're still in talks with several, and we think we'll have many allies who are in crucial areas of First Amendment who will be supporting us. A brief for a petitioner or in support of neither party arrived yesterday, and we're still digesting all of the briefs that came in. There were a few briefs that were filed by what I would call a various corporate interests. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce filed a brief. The Internet Association filed a brief. And what I think is actually quite telling about those briefs is they filed their briefs in support of neither party. They did not support petitioner MNN. They supported the interests of large businesses, but those associations expressly recognize that the interests of even large businesses that they're representing in this case are not antagonistic to us. They recognize that Didi and Papaletto can win their case and still that they're not opposed to us in that respect. So we think that's quite encouraging that those organizations filed in support of neither party. There were a handful of conservative legal organizations who filed in support of petitioner on the basis that MNN is not a state actor because of an assertion about private property that maintained that MNN controls as to the channel. We think that's just a fundamentally misguided principle because the channel does not, in fact, own any station rights. They're merely the temporary caretaker of that station for the period of time that the city allows them to do so. As Didi says, there's nothing that is set in stone about whether or not MNN will continue to have this right forever into the future. Every time there's a franchise renewal or contract renewal, that can be changed from one party to another. As Didi also explained, there have been situations outside New York when that operator has been changed from one nonprofit to another. So we think that notion that there is a property interest that is owned by the station operator is simply incorrect. To the extent there is a property interest, it's plainly owned by the city that controls who is the temporary custodian of that station for a term-limited period of time.
Didi Halleck, in your book, Handheld Visions, which I read to my edification, it's a very fine book. You talk about the early days of community radio. I remember when I first met you, you were described to me by our mutual friend Karen Renucci as the mother of community radio and grassroots videography. Now, there are about six huge corporations that really control the major media. So my question is, what were you trying to do in the early days, and where do we stand now?
Well, you know, some people have said, well, there's the Internet, and that will solve everyone's problems in terms of getting information and being able to express yourself. But I think it's very important that we have these institutions, nonprofits, that are able to help facilitate different communities to make sure that they have their voices heard. That's always been my interest. I have a website, deepdishwavesofchange.org, www.mediamatters.org, which looks at community media around the world. It's always been a big interest of mine to see how people have been so creative in building different kinds of ways of getting their messages out. And certainly public access is something that's looked on throughout the world as an important way that that people have been able to sort of tax the big media corporations to enable community groups and individuals to express themselves. So I feel that it's very important to have these kind of bases so that the equipment can be shared. I recently was up in Vermont at a public access channel there in Montpelier. It happened to be the week before the midterms. It was people were running in and out of that place. It was amazing to get mixers and microphones and cameras to tape the many debates that were going on. I just talked to somebody from Vermont. They said they put on 110 debates over the last month about the different issues that were coming up in those elections. Now, those people would not have been able to do that work if they didn't have that media center there with the equipment, with the assistance. That's what public access has been across the country. It's been a real hub for people being able to work collectively.
The Second Circuit held that MNN was a state actor. What were MNN's arguments against that finding?
Well, MNN has focused on several of the different state action tests. I think they've taken something of a shotgun approach, not focusing on any one of the particular tests. And their claim is that the Second Circuit's approach to the state action test was more amorphous than where the Supreme Court's doctrine has been. In our view, though, what the Second Circuit did was quite clearly an application of the public function doctrine, that it's long been established that if a municipality hands off a public function to a private corporation or a nonprofit entity, that entity performs a public function is thus a state actor with respect to that particular function. We think that's exactly what the Second Circuit did in this case, and the basis on which the Supreme Court's going to ultimately rule in our favor.
Now, on a related note, why does MNN so dearly not want to be a state actor?
What do you think of that, Dee Dee? Why do you think that they're digging in their heels on this one?
They don't want to have a transparency and accountability, for sure. There's all kinds of questions about some of their financial situation, and I think that actually a friend who was on the board said that she wanted to apply, help them, because for the previous director, she had written grants for them from different foundations, et cetera, very successfully. She helped to start the youth channel with additional money. And she was told, no, that they did not want to ever apply for any external funding. And she realized that the reason the ED didn't want to was he didn't want that kind of openness of the kind of accountability that they would have to do to apply for grants. So I think they want to keep the organization closed, and that's my problem. It didn't start that way, and it should have that kind of public accountability.
Well, not just for MNN, but any nonprofit incorporated in the state of New York, a 501c3, is rated in terms of their transparency and accountability.
It's weird because MNN is not accountable to the Public Service Commission. None of the city access centers are. They were taken out, and one of the things I think needs to be found out is why that happened. They were moved to Do It, which is like a black hole. Once you go, you can't get any information from them. It's Do It is the New York City Department of Information Technology. and telecommunications.
Well, we're running out of our lot of time, Paul and Dee Dee, but I wanted to ask you, first of all, what's the timetable on this? When are we going to get a decision? And secondly, how can listeners learn more about this case?
Paul?
So this case is going to be argued at the Supreme Court in February of the 2019, and the Supreme Court will issue a decision sometime between the end of March and I would anticipate June of 2019. So we'll know by next summer at the latest. All of the briefs that have been filed in this case to date are available on the Supreme Court's website. If one goes on and searches the docket for Dee Dee Halleck's name, you'll instantly find all of the cases, all of the briefs that have been filed, and you can follow along as new briefs are filed in the case. There's an additional website, SCOTUSblog.com, which also has all of the materials compiled there. So that those are some of the best places to see the original source documents, to read everything that has been filed in this case.
I just want to say that it's very interesting to me that none of the left media has really covered this, and I want to thank you guys for taking this up as a subject on Law and Disorder, because there have been a lot of articles, but they're all in like legal blogs and things. It's amazing. There's almost, and we're also, somebody put us up on Wikipedia, but with a lot of disinformation there, so it's not being covered, and I really appreciate this.
Well, we promise you that we're going to continue to cover
yes.
this case, and we promise you that we'll have you both back on when we win it next year.
Exactly. Thank you for your hard work, Dee Dee, and Paul, it was great to meet you.
Thanks so much, Paul. Thank you, Dee Dee.
Thank you.
Take it easy.
Thank you both.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.